Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Hi.
You're looking good.
I'm good.
Looking good. Okay, great. So, yeah, so today what we're going to get into is we're going to talk about foreign intervention, the U.S. intervening in other countries. So recently we've had the Afghanistan pullout. We've had like the 20-year war in Afghanistan that cost $2 trillion. Lots of blood, and eventually started with the Taliban and ruling Afghanistan, ended with the Taliban ruling Afghanistan. So now we're in the situation where the whole question of U.S. intervention after the Iraq thing, after Afghanistan, after Vietnam, and so many other examples is coming into question. And even Americans themselves are doubting it. They're like, why do we keep on doing this over and over again? But it's not just that. So today, I think we're going to actually uncover more sides of this, right, which I think Armin's going to talk about, and we're going to really get into U.S. intervention, the criteria for when the U.S. typically intervenes, and whether it should or not, and what the pluses and the minuses are, and how the landscape has changed in recent years.
Right.
So,
yeah. And before we start, I just have to say that we have a Patreon question by D, which we get to at the end. Just a reminder to people who can't join us live, but they're patrons. You know, if the hour that we go live is not convenient for them, because as a patron, you can still send us your questions ahead of time, and we'll make sure that we answer your patron questions. So, if you're a patron and you can't join us live, you could definitely take advantage of that. And if you're listening to this and you're not a patron, link in the description, you can become a patron and support the show at the same time. Anyway, so where do we start? I mean, I have so much to say about this. I could spend 8 hours talking about this, but I'm not going to.
Do you want to start with, I think, just talking about the basics of what is the, like, generally, what are the criteria that the United States uses to intervene? I know that they had the Reagan doctrine, they had the Bush doctrine, they had the Obama doctrine. Like, they're different criteria, the different presidents, but more or less, they're quite similar. But what do you understand?
Yeah, I'm going to test this theory with you, Ellie, because I know so many people are so pessimistic that they would agree with me on this. But like the average person online is not a very good way for me to evaluate how right or wrong I'm about this, because people just accept all sorts of conspiracy theories, right? But I'm going to make the argument, and I know this is like really Twitter-ish point to make, but I'm going to make the argument that it's mostly based on how profitable the weapon deals are and what makes a lot of these decisions are based on. It seems like I'm going to make that argument. And I know like a lot of people like, obviously, Armin, that's not even a question. Why would you even think that that's not so obvious? I mean, I'm referring to you when I'm saying Twitter-ish argument, if you're thinking about that, because I don't want people oh, it's all about the money and trades. Like that's, I want to be able to make arguments to demonstrate that that's the case rather than just going with whatever feels like the most evil thing possible, which I think a lot of people tend to do, right?
But is that really more of an association, or is it because the thing is that it is multifactorial. I mean, there are several different reasons why the U.S. intervenes in different places. This would be one of the factors that you think, or
I think it's one of the main factors. However, I'm not arguing that interventions are wrong. Okay. There are, you know, I think like there are examples of good intervention. And even the interventions that are good could still be motivated mostly by economics. Like it's not just a weapons deal if it's not the weapons industry, it's some other industry. It's like trade. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's still at the end of the day, it's still economic evaluations way before, I don't know, human rights and stuff like that. I mean, even when it is human rights, it's human rights because stability causes better trade deals and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Right. I mean, I'm not saying human rights and people's lives is not part of the calculation. I'm just saying it's not priority number one, two, three, four, five, maybe like somewhere down the, it's somewhere way down the list, right? It's still better. Like when it comes to Western countries, like United States, Canada, and Western European countries, I mean, it's hard to defend them on this, given their record. But I would still argue that human rights is higher on their list compared to countries like, I don't know, Russia, China, Iran, you know what I mean? But I know, like, the reason why that seems obvious to you, Ali, but some people would argue otherwise, is because of, like, I mean, they're like, well, what are you talking about? Look at United States with their cooperation with Saudi Arabia in Yemen, and how many lives is that costing? Look at what they did in Cambodia, right? Look at what they did here or there. Like, are these not human rights violations? Or I mean, they are. They definitely are. But that doesn't mean that human rights has zero effect. It's not a binary thing, okay? I mean, it would be worse if China was the world superpower. That's what I'm saying, right? Mm. Like, it is bad, and we do condemn these. And they're really bad. They're horrible. And we might highlight some of them here today to show, like, how bad they are. But again, just because something is bad, it doesn't mean it was the worst possible situation. It's still, like, we still do have, I mean, human rights organizations and public opinion of these on the politicians in these countries has some effect. It doesn't have the level of effect that we want. There are many other elements that has bigger effect, like, I don't know, weapon, you know, the profitability of the weapons deals. Those, to me, it seems like they have a much higher effect. However, these other elements, like people's opinions on the politicians and human rights organizations pressuring politicians, they do have some effect. Like, I feel like in a country like China, they have almost zero effect. I mean, no, they don't have zero effect. I mean, no, actually, that's not true. Even there, they have some. I mean, if, for example, if the international pressure on China didn't exist when it comes to their human rights violation and Uyghur Muslims, it would be worse. Like, even there is there's some effect. But anyways, I do want to go and compare. I want to let you make your point. But then I do want to go and say why we shouldn't, like, throw out, like, just because we have examples of really bad interventions and bad results, we shouldn't throw the whole thing out and just be like, we shouldn't do any intervention. I want to make that argument, but go on.
I agree with you. No, I was going to add to the human rights thing. I mean, I think what it seems like to me is that there is it's basically a national interest thing. So economic interest, strategic interest, defense interest, whatever it is, it seems like that's a main priority. The human rights thing, I think, comes in when in Afghanistan, they go in, you know, they do that, they take out the Taliban, but then they stay there and start nation building. In Iraq and in Afghanistan, they start, like, training the troops and start doing all of these other things. The nation building aspect of it, I think that's something that the U.S. does uniquely, and it's just usually not successful, and where a lot of these other people would just go in, do what they need to do, and then get out.
I mean, yeah, other countries did try to do nation building as well and fail. Like, I mean, Russia, so the Soviet Union tried to do nation building, I guess.
Yeah, they did, I guess. There's a, and I think that there's, like, the criteria that they have, the way that it changed, I think before Bush Sr., it was kind of different. And then after Bush Sr., it became a little bit different. Like, when Bush he went into Saudi Arabia and for the war against Iraq, when Iraq took over Kuwait. At that point, you know, he had this, he's like, okay, well, locally, do we have support? Yeah, we have support of, like, other Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and so on. So, you know, we're allowed to go in there. And then do we have a UN resolution? Let's go to the UN. Let's get a coalition together. This whole thing about getting a UN coalition together to go into war and, you know, defining that there's some sort of strategic interest as well. So there are several, like, that list of criteria of forming coalitions, finding regional support and everything is something that I think is relatively recent. By recent, I mean about 30, 40 years ago, like with Bush Senior. Now, before that, it wasn't really like that.
Well, okay, but I do want us to now consider whether intervention as a whole is a good or bad thing by the U.S. and maybe even other Western countries, right? The thing I want to highlight is that in every decision that every decision that politicians make or these countries make, it will always have negative effects. Okay, so the thing that we have to, the way that we have to calculate is like a lot of people just point to the negative effects and say like, oh, here's the negative effects, therefore this was bad. Well, if you didn't do that, it will have other negative effects, right? So what you're trying to figure out is what among all options, like let's say you have option A, B, C, or D, and there's no other options, like even like doing nothing, I'm including that as one of the options, right? But all of these options will have devastating effects. You're trying to see which one would have the least devastating effect. And again, this seems like contradicting what I said before, because what I'm saying is that the intentions of these countries might not even be saving lives and human race and all. But saying that doesn't mean that we should like give up on pressuring these politicians. So the way we look at it, like the way a lot of people look at it, like, oh, look at the motivation is this. The motivation is not saving people's lives and bringing, you know, peace and stability and democracy or whatever. So therefore, why are we even trying to motivate them to do this instead of that? Like, yeah, but you as a citizen or you as an activist, you have that ability to exert the pressure, right? So whatever their intentions are, you could make it costly for them. You as a human rights institution or a political activist or whatever, or as a voter, you could make it more politically and economically costly for these politicians to not make the decisions that actually benefit the most number of human beings, right? So just because these other factors seem to be a bigger factor, that doesn't mean the human rights factor could not go from, I don't know, factor number 7 to factor number 6. You know, you have that influence, right? So here's the thing. To see which options have the least negative effects, I'm going to simplify things and say, let's say there's a human rights violation somewhere happening around the world, or there's a genocide or like something really bad. Okay. So a lot of people say, don't intervene. Whenever we intervene, we cause more problems than solutions. Right. But the thing is that if you don't intervene, a lot of the same people will be like, what happened to never forget? Like the whole message from World War II. What was the message from World War II? Never forget.
Never forget.
The world, like, imagine if all these atrocities were happening and other countries just stood by and let a lot of people just be massacred or their rights being taken away. Then the messaging, like, it's not like if that was happening and these North American and Western European countries weren't intervening, it would be the world would be like, oh yeah, I'm so glad that my politicians are not intervening, you know, because they're saying that because they saw what happens when they intervene. But if they saw what happens when they don't intervene, they will still be mad. They would be like, oh, we're just standing by idly as like these peoples are being killed. Like, what have these politicians care about? They don't care about human beings. They only care about their own people. They're racist. If they actually cared, they would get involved. Like, what happened to World War II? What happened to never, like, the message from World War II? Never again, never again, never forget. What's the point of all these, memorials? Okay, so that would be the thing, right? I mean, like Rwanda happened and, nobody did anything and people were mad. People were like, why didn't nobody stop this? Why did the world didn't get involved? So when you get involved, people get mad. When you don't get involved, people get mad as well, right? But what are the options? Maybe it's not about, so our argument is not about whether you're getting involved or not. The argument should be how you're getting involved. You know what I mean? Like maybe a lot of these involvement, maybe a lot of these interventions were just done very badly. And if they were done, in a better way, it would have been, you know, more ideal. I mean, at the end of the day, there will always be cost to any decision you're making. So the options are do nothing, intervene using military, or intervene using economic leverages, which would be like sanctions or trade agreements or tariffs or stuff like that, right? So we could say nothing, war, or sanctions, I guess, is a summary. And the war part and the sanction part could be done better, right? Like, for example, the criticism with the war is like what you referred to, Ali, like your nation building, right? Instead of actually, like, we have examples of American intervention alongside other countries that were successful, right? I mean, people think that they have to, I used to think like, I used to argue that, oh, you have to go all the way back to World War II to show good intervention. And we haven't had any good intervention since, but, you know, by United States. But actually, that's wrong. Like, you could refer to the Kosovo War and the Bosnian War. I mean, people now think of like bad examples of intervention is Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Somalia, but we do have examples of successful intervention, like the Kosovo War and the Bosnian War, where United States, as part of NATO, maybe that's one reason why it's a better intervention, is because it didn't just do it, you know, by itself, got involved with the got involved in those wars, and they actually stopped violence and they brought stability in both of those very successfully. And so what's the difference? What's the difference between those interventions and these other interventions that we are talking about that are bad and that were unsuccessful? And I think the main one is what Ali just referred to, is in these bad examples, like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Somalia interventions, they started nation building. Like, I mean, it started as a more specific action, but then it turned into something much bigger. Like, the good examples, like the Kosovo War and the Bosnian War, the mission was narrow in scope. It was just like, we're going to go there and stop the violence. We're like, they weren't there to nation build. They just went there to introduce stability. So maybe that's the reason why they were more successful. Yeah. Or maybe I have other reasons why they might be more successful.
I just want to make one point that you said, you know, when they went into Afghanistan, they started nation building. That was actually a reaction to something they did before. And this goes with your damned if you do, damned if you don't thesis, is that when they went into Afghanistan in the 80s, right? In the 80s to fight the Soviets, at that time, they didn't stay. They didn't nation build. As soon as their job was done, they left. They cut and ran. And that's something that Pakistanis...
Where?
In Afghanistan in the 80s, right?
Okay. They
were fighting the Soviet Union. So the biggest complaint was they cut and ran, and all these weapons went into Pakistan, and then, you know, all of this, all the drugs went into Pakistan. You had Kalashnikov culture and all this stuff. Those are Russian AK-47s. And then after that, you know, that's how the Taliban arose, and that's how, you know, eventually Al-Qaeda went into Afghanistan, and then eventually 9/11 happened. So there's that whole cycle, and that is largely blamed on the U.S. not staying there and just cutting and running. So yeah, again, that's at that time, it didn't work for them. Then the second time, they decided to stay there for a little bit longer. That didn't work for them either. So that's also another thing. And, you know, it's specifically with the T word. Can we say it or no? So with the terrorism, they keep on saying that, you know, okay, if we don't intervene, then, you know, we need to go and we have to stop the terrorism. And that does kind of work. At least, I mean, right now the timeline isn't long enough for us to know whether there's going to be a, you know, 2.0 Islamic State or anything like that. We don't know that yet, but it does. Like they're in Iraq, in Afghanistan, when they partnered up with the military in Pakistan, the Yemen thing, all of in Syria, in all of these places, when the U.S. intervenes or at least plays some role, even if they play a sort of covert intervention role, the Islamic radicalism kind of increases. You know, you have all these parties that grow up. That's at least been the recent record. So it is it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, specifically when they intervene in sort of Muslim and Arab regions, right? It always seems to tend to backfire. Every time they ally themselves with the moderate Muslim opposition, like they did in Syria, it never really turns out well because they become more and more extreme, right? So it's a it's a really difficult question.
Well, okay, but the reason I have more reasons than nation building for why it might have not worked in these countries compared to the. But I just want people to know, because I hear a lot of people say that, oh, give me every time we intervene, we screw things up. So we should stop intervening. I mean, like, every time? Are you sure about that? Like, I just wanted to make sure that we do mention the examples of, no, not every time. There was actually, we have examples of people benefiting, like violence stopping, people living, war right. stopping because of these interventions.
So and non-intervention has also caused issues. Yes. Like when there was the red line in Syria that Obama had when he didn't do it. I mean, that caused a lot of problems. The non-intervention in the early 90s, before they actually went into Bosnia, the early 90s with Bosnia.
I mean, the most famous, I don't know about that, but the most famous non-intervention is Rwanda one.
Yeah, Rwanda as well. Like, no, but in the early 90s, right? Like the Bosnia, the biggest complaint was, why did it take you so long? This genocide was happening for ages. And in the early 90s, they said that because the U.S. didn't intervene, that's why all this sort of Islamic radicalism started increasing in that region, the Balkans. So whether it's non-intervention or intervention, this is the actual conflict. This is the problem with the
damage. But can I go through the reasons why I think like the difference between the good interventions and the bad interventions? Okay,
go for it.
So the main one that we addressed was like one of them was ended up being nation building, and the other one seemed the successful one seemed to be narrow. And like it was specific actions rather than like an entire changing of a country. And it's like, it's amazing because it wasn't just, I just want to talk a little bit about the nation building, because the nation building had such an optimistic goal, like goals like we want to introduce gender equality in Afghanistan and create a multi-ethnic government. I was like, well, good luck with that. I mean, like, completely change years of culture and people's understanding. Just what do you think is going to happen? Just because you're here, people's like entire mindsets is going to change over a decade? Like, no. Like, I mean, it seems so now. I mean, this is in power of hindsight, but like the whole idea of like, oh yeah, we're going to be here, and because we're here, you guys are going to now, your values are going to change, and you're just going to love human rights and the rule of law. Like, why? It's how you're like, there's opinions of people's values are not just going to change because you're there. No, but so the main thing, okay, so here's the thing. There's a major difference in culture in these other countries. Like the difference, so the examples I give, like the Bosnia and the Kosovo, the gap between the culture and the values of these countries from the United States is much smaller than the gap between the culture of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Somalia with the United States, right? So it's easier when it comes to being in a country in the Balkans, and if you're there and you're trying to, I mean, this respect for like somewhat of a respect for rule of law and human rights, you know, you're not there to completely change people's mindset about how the world's supposed to be. So it's easier to fill that, to meet that gap. Like people want the war to stop. Like, you know what I mean? People want human rights. People want the rule of law. They want those things, right? So that's one reason. Like the gap between the culture might be one reason why they're more successful over there. You know, like there's a demand for democracy over there by people. So that's a cultural gap that is different, but also a geographical gap that makes a huge difference that people, I think, don't appreciate. I mean, like when we're talking about the, you know, Kosovo and Bosnia, we're talking about the United States getting involved through NATO. I mean, this is like from Europe, in Europe. So the it's local, like it's not far away. Like, I don't know if people understand how big of a difference distance makes and how successful military actions are. Like, it's amazing. Like, even when in regional places, if you look at, I don't know, the conflict, if you study the conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, you notice like how just a small amount of extra distance between the targets and the places that the plane are supposed to take off from just makes like billions of dollars worth of you know, billions of dollars in difference in what the strategy will entail, like the entire technology that you have to use and the capability you have would just make it would make night and day difference if your target was just one city farther than where you're launching your attacks from. Like, it's amazing how much of a difference it makes. This is why you see so many of these countries like in the Islamic Republic of Iran trying to invest in missiles that have a broader range. I mean, planes, how much distance they could go without being fueled again. It just makes so much difference in how much the cost of the war is going to be, right? So, like, yes, United States is a world superpower by a huge margin, but people don't understand that taking military action in countries that are so far away from the United States, like in Afghanistan or Iraq, is just so much harder than defending your own base. I mean, United States is constantly getting better at that, with drone technology and everything. But still, I mean, this is what happened with the British Empire, right? Like, they were spreading themselves all across the planet. So that's really hard to do. So again, one reason what maybe the Bosnian and the Kosovo intervention was better is because they were more local and far away. So I think that's all I have of the difference, the culture difference, the distance, and nation building versus specific action. I do want to say that when it comes, so we talked about the difference between good intervention and bad intervention when it comes to military action. But there is also a difference between good intervention and bad intervention when it comes to sanctions and economic pressure.
Right.
This is like now there's a lot of talk about coming up with sanctions that are way more targeted, because a lot of sanctions have collateral damage and a lot of innocent people suffer from sanctions, right? But people who are against sanctions, they have to, like, as a whole, and people are like, oh my God, look at all these people suffering from sanctions. I mean, that's a very good point. But again, the alternative to sanctions is either doing nothing or war. If you're anti-war, and if you're also anti-sanctions, then you are, when it comes to facing human rights violations, then what are you for? Are you for just ignoring human rights violations? So if you're one of those people that is completely against any form of military action, and you want your country to do something when it comes to respond to human rights violations, then what else is there other than economic pressure? So when it comes to economic pressure, I think there needs to be, I mean, there is a lot more talk when it comes to coming up with this gets very complicated. Like, now all of a sudden the discussion turns from like, what is the best military strategy, to it becomes very financy and it gets very complicated, and it comes like, you see a lot of economic and financial experts coming up with the most creative, bizarre ways to make sure that, like, for example, if you want to come up with smart sanctions, right? That's what they call them, smarter sanctions. How do you make it so that the IRGC is suffering, but the Iranian people are not suffering, given that the IRGC holds like a vast majority of Iran's economy goes through the IRGC? Like, if you want to target the IRGC, people's daily lives are going to be influenced by that, you know. But one way is to make it life very miserable, economic life very difficult for specific individuals. But again, that's very hard for, how do you do that when their entire economy is just local? Like, of that specific person's, like, finances is entirely local. I mean, they seem to say that there are ways to do that. It's just very complicated. But at least there is an effort, right? But again, like, I just want to let people know that, like, oh, sanctions are making people suffer, like, therefore we shouldn't do it. They're just simplifying things. Like, none of these options are ideal. None of these options are going to have, like, doing nothing is also going to have collateral damage, right? So they just make it seem like it's so obvious and so easy. Like, oh, sanctions are bad, so do nothing? Like, that's also going to have collateral damage. Don't make it seem like this is a binary, like, on or off switch. Or we had a bad experience doing this, so shut it all down and never do anything. It's just so dumb that people think like that. But yeah, you should say something, because I've been speaking for
Yeah, I think what you're saying about how the intervention is done is, a key point, right? And also kind of looking at the political landscape there. And an example of how is, for instance, you know, using drones, right? The drone thing was very controversial. Obviously, the people who are total 100% pacifists, as you described, they're going to be against anything. But the drones actually were one of the most surgical ways of getting at things, and they actually minimized civilian casualties. I mean, there were a lot of civilian casualties during Bush's era, but then the Obama administration actually made it so the civilian casualties towards the end of it were almost zero. Right. So there's
I thought Obama, is that true? I thought Obama had high civilian casualties when it comes
to. No, it wasn't. That wasn't. So there were, it depends who did the reports, right? So there were some people who were, there was the, I think, International Bureau of Journalism, or I can't remember the I can't remember what it was called. The main organization that came out and said the civilian casualties, but they had gotten all of their figures from the press, from media reports, and from internal reports, like the Pakistani Taliban were actually reporting from south of Waziristan, you know, what the casualties were, and so they were obviously giving their own number. So there were a lot of issues with it, but ultimately, I think, I mean, if you read Peter Bergen and some of the things that he's written, you'll realize that the civilian casualties actually declined. So the drones were actually, and then Farhad Taj, who's from the region, the journalist, actually said that people, when they were there, you know, they had the Taliban on one side, they had Pakistan military planes on the other side, and they were all fighting each other. They were caught in the crossfire. So when they heard drones, they knew that in most cases they would be safe if they're not doing anything because the strikes were so surgical. So, I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but that's an example of the how you intervene. The other thing is, like, you have to look at the political landscape, right? In the Middle East, generally, in most of these Arab countries, and we saw that, I think, everywhere, you have these two sides. Right? You have these dictatorships, like, often, and just sometimes they're secular, sometimes they're not, but either way, they're very repressive. They're repressive dictatorships. And then you have these opposition groups and organizations, which are most of the time sort of Islamic organizations. And those are the two things you have. And there isn't really a whole lot of room in between. And whenever, you know, all of these, even the Democrats in the U.S. say, well, we've got to ally ourselves with the moderates, there's really no such thing. And this is something I think Fareed Zakaria also pointed out, like, several times, that there's no such thing as allying themselves with the moderates. And when the Syria thing happened, the U.S. was deciding whether to intervene in Syria after that chemical weapons attack that Syria did on its own people, that Assad did. You know, Obama had made that, you remember that famous red line that, you know, okay, if they do a chemical weapons attack, then I'm going to go in, I'm going to intervene. And then he found a way to weasel out of it, right, by using sort of Russia saying, okay, we'll take the weapons, we'll take hold of it. And he's like, oh, okay, I trust Russia. That's basically what happened. And the reason he didn't want to, the reason he couldn't commit to that whole red line thing and follow through, is because on the one hand, you had Assad, and on the other hand, the opposition that was fighting Assad was eventually going to turn into, I mean, that was becoming the Islamic State, right? So you had these two, I mean, you had the Free Syrian Army, you had all of these other things, but they were all sort of coalescing into a more extreme, really religious, really angry opposition that was going to just, there was no good way to go about it. So there were people, I see one of the comments here, I think Dee Boudreau is saying, Dee Boudreau was talking about how in Syria, protesters were holding signs saying, Obama, please do something. But if he had done something, if he'd gone in, he would have been caught in the crossfire between a repressive dictatorship and these sort of like super highly like militant Islamic oppositions. And no matter what side you took, whoever you're fighting against, it would have been a disaster. And then when he didn't intervene, same thing. I mean, eventually you had the formation of the Islamic State. So a lot of times when we look back and we say, well, if we had done this other thing, then things would have been different. That's not necessarily true either. Like, you know, if the U.S. hadn't, I mean, I don't support the U.S.'s intervention in Iraq. That's clearly a mistake. But, you know, if the U.S. hadn't, you had the Arab Spring, you would have had this massive opposition. If Saddam Hussein was still in power, you would have had the problem. I mean, this is a possible scenario. You would have had a possible opposition against Saddam Hussein, just like there was in Syria and against Gaddafi in Libya and in Tunisia and in Egypt and all these other places. You would have had that in Iraq as well. And that would have been either clamped down on or something aggressive would have happened. And you may have seen the birth of the Islamic State in Iraq just the same as you did because of the Iraq war. So there are, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. There's no way in these places when you have these two extremes of repressive dictatorships and Islamic militant oppositions and very little room in the middle, there's really no way to go back and tell, well, if we had done this other thing, or if we had intervened or not intervened, or if we had sided with this side instead of that side, would things have been different? There is no way to tell. There's no way to tell. And that's that may be an argument for non-intervention, but sometimes it can be an argument for intervention as well.
All right. I do want to start for us to start talking about the greatest intervention that just happened. Okay. Which is one of the greatest interventions since, like, I don't know if people understand the significance of what just happened recently. And I don't know why is it that we plan these streams and then before these kind of events happen, and then something so relevant to the topic of the stream happens after we already had scheduled the stream, right?
Because they're all patrons. They're all watching us.
So what just happened, basically, what I'm referring to, I think people know what I'm referring to in the live chat, is, again, guys, I have no idea how this happens. Like, right before the stream, like just maybe a day or two before the stream, we had this trilateral security pack between United States, the UK, and Australia, which is referred to as AUKUS. AUKUS is like supposed to be AU, Australia, UK, and the US. So that's why you're referring to it as AUKUS. And I mean, it goes beyond just submarines, but the main highlight of it is the fact that United States is giving Australia nuclear power submarines. Okay. And this is such a big deal. This is a huge deal. And when it comes to interventions, this, I know it doesn't feel like it, but this level of intervention is, you know, comparable to like the whole Iraq situation or Afghanistan situation. It just doesn't seem like it because it's like, so it's just a lot more quiet, right? You know, like bombs are not going off, but this has much longer lasting effects, you know, than these other things that have happened. Like to show you how big of a, so for people who might not know what this deal is about, Australia now gets to have nuclear power submarines. Okay. And I know a lot of people, they are making it sound like this is not an anti-China intervention, but this is definitely an anti-China intervention. Okay. And to demonstrate how big of a deal this is for people who might not know, United States has been very, very, very picky about its nuclear technology and nuclear power submarine technology. It has been guarding that. Like, that is not something it will just hand out to any country, right? The only time that they gave anything like that, like that sort of technology to another country, was during the Cold War, and they gave it to the UK, right? So because UK was like United States' major ally in the Cold War, so some people are saying like this for this to only happen now a second time, for United States to now give this to Australia, the only time this happened before was during the Cold War. So they're like, are you suggesting that the China threat to United States is as significant as the Soviet Union threat was during the Cold War? Like, is that how big of a deal the threat is being treated, the China threat is being treated, that something that United States was so picky about not sharing is now being shared with Australia? And by the way, this is the only reason why I think the UK is involved in this deal, because this is mostly a deal between United States and Australia. So people are like, what is UK doing in this deal? Because UK had access to these submarines, so they had to be part of this deal. I don't know why. I mean, this is just a guess, right? So, but by the way, it's important to point out, as the prime ministers and presidents of all these three countries constantly seem to want to point out in their speeches, that these submarines do not have nuclear weapons. they are nuclear powered. And a lot of people think that, some people seem to think like, okay, they don't have nuclear weapons. Like, this is like, they're just nuclear powered. So what's the big deal? It is a huge deal. These submarines are death machines. Okay. Like, these submarines are, can flatten cities. Okay. Like, that's how big of a deal these submarines are. Like, you know, a lot of the deals, a lot of the weapon deals, big weapon deals that we're seeing, a lot of them are useless. And they're, you know, people can tell, experts can tell, like, why are you even doing this deal? This is not going to help you in the war that you're involved with. Like we see that constantly when, like, United States is selling weapons to Afghanistan, people are like, that's not the weapons Afghanistan needs. When United States sells weapons to, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, you can see how bad they are at it. Like, they keep losing to Yemen, even though they have much more effect, you know, much bigger. You see a lot of costly weapon deals, and you see, like, United States building planes that are so inefficient and tanks that are just never going to be used, just left in the desert. This is not one of those deals, okay? This is not one of those inefficient, you know, planes or tanks. Or big weapons that are not very effective during, you know, the war, the current wars that these countries are involved with. These are very, very, this is like a serious defense against China. This is like, this is in China's backyard. United States is like, we're here now. And like, when it comes to showing China that we brought the big boys and you're back in your backyard, nothing would send that message bigger than this deal that just happened, right? These are machines, like the way that is people are describing it, like these submarines by themselves with no backup, with no support, like your home country could have been like completely destroyed, and as long as these submarines are somewhere down there in the deep in the water, they could still without any back in support, just like raise your cities to the ground. And they're so incredibly hard to find. Like, they're just deep in the ocean and they have these missiles that just send to your cities and you can't find them. They're undetectable and there's nothing you could do, just like swimming around, and they could just keep flattening your cities without you doing it. Like, I don't know what to do. This is like a ghost sending missiles to your city. That's what they're like. Okay. So they are incredibly destructive, deadly machines, and they are a major response. Like, this is like makes China, like, I know we're seeing China as this like emerging superpower that's going to be a military threat to the world, to the West at some point. That's how people are describing it as. Like, by the way, when we say military threat, we're not actually talking about war, because obviously China and United States are not going to enter any wars or anything like that. They're too much in their economies are too interdependent. Which actually, if I quickly want to touch back on what we were saying before when it comes to what to do, I forgot to mention, like, when I said there are three options: nothing, economic pressure, and military action. The economic pressure is not just sanctions. The economic pressure could also be trade, right? If our politicians actually didn't care about these, you know, increasing the profits of these weapon deals and actually reduce war, if that was the main priority, the best thing to do was improving the economy of all the countries that you're having a struggle with, because and making them a great customer base for you to sell stuff to, right? Actually, here's one of the benefits of capitalism, is that it could reduce war, right? If the economy of countries like, I don't know, Iran and Afghanistan grows, these people will buy stuff, and then you want to sell stuff to them, and then it's much less likely for you to go into war with countries that you have economic ties to. Like, one form of meddling that I would be very much in favor of is trade agreements, something that Obama was heavily focused on. Like, trade agreements is the best way to stop wars and also to improve human rights, right? If the economy of a country keeps improving, it has such a it has a huge positive effect on their human rights. Apparently, when more people make more money, when your citizens make more money and they're a source of your taxes rather than natural resources, it's less likely for the governments to actually mistreat their own people, right? So this would be the main way to actually reduce war and improve human rights at the same time, right? Capitalism, right? But the problem is that the money from the weapon industry is just too good. And I'm actually going to use this AUKUS agreement that just happened as a way to show how big of a deal these weapon deals are, okay? But I'm going to get to that point. But Ali, do you want to add anything to this, what I said so far, before I continue with this line of reasoning to get to that conclusion?
No. Actually, this has been actually what I knew a little bit about the AUKUS deal, but I didn't know... but everything you talk about, so I'm actually learning a lot here, but keep going.
Right. So the people who are saying that this is a new Cold War, I think they're exaggerating, right? Again, China's economy and United States economy are dependent on each other so much. It is within China's interest for United States economy to improve, and it's within United States interest for China's economy to improve. I don't know if people understand that these countries benefit from each other's success. That's not what the situation was during the Cold War. And again, a lot of people say like, oh my God, this is really bad. This is going to start a war. I mean, it's likely that I don't know actually, but it's possible. I changed likely to possible that because I don't know. That these submarines and stuff like that might be a form of good intervention, because these might have stabilizing effect rather than like it just makes war a lot more costly. Again, I don't know. I'm going to tell you what the critics will say if people want to hear that of this AUKUS deal. Again, this is not Australia getting nuclear weapons. Australia has an obligation to its nuclear non-proliferation treaty, right? So they will not have nuclear weapon. In fact, Australia is now the only country that doesn't have nuclear weapons but has nuclear power submarines. Every other country that has nuclear power submarines, which I think there's six of them, has also nuclear weapons. But again, that doesn't mean that these are not deadly weapons. These submarines have a lot higher weapon storage. They are very fast. They can stay submerged under the water for months. Like, they could just stay under the water without any refueling or anything and just go undetected, which is amazing, okay? So the point I'm trying to make with this deal, with this type of intervention, first of all, it could be a stabilizing intervention. I don't know. I'm going to tell you what the counter argument is. However, the reaction of France to this deal is very telling, okay, in my opinion, okay, because France was supposed to sell submarines, not nuclear power submarines, but like conventional submarines to Australia, okay, and they just got, this was like, nobody told France that, oh yeah, the deal that you had with Australia, the conventional submarines, the not nuclear ones that you're supposed to sell to Australia, it's not going to go through. They didn't, like, Australia didn't tell France, United States didn't tell France, UK didn't tell France. France found out that their deal with Australia is not going to go through the same, like, with the rest of us.
So the negotiations were done behind their back.
Like, yeah, behind their back, and they found that last minute. Like, they found out when we found out.
And the deal was worth, I think, what, $60 billion or something like that?
$50 billion. I heard $50 billion.
Oh, okay. Yeah, around that.
Maybe much. I'm wrong.
Yeah. It was a big deal, basically. France, and then it wasn't going to go through. So that's a big shock to them.
Yeah, it was a big deal, and we can understand why France is angry with Australia and United States. For some reason, they don't seem to be very upset with UK.
They recalled the ambassadors, though. They haven't recalled the UK.
Not from UK. Oh. No, they're okay. But here's the thing. This is the key part. Okay, so they recalled their ambassadors from US and Australia. Maybe by the time you're listening to this podcast, maybe by that time they also recalled it from the UK. But so far, by the time that we're listening, they haven't recalled their ambassador from US or Australia. But guys, let me tell you why this is such a big deal, okay? France did not, okay, France has had tensions with United States, okay? France had has had tensions with the United States over the Iraq war. You guys remember that? Calling French fries freedom fries and stuff like that, right? Right?
So, freedom kissing. Remember freedom kissing.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking about that. Yeah, but go ahead.
No, okay, wait. Okay, hold on. What was I saying? Yep. France had had issues with the United States over you know, human rights violations in Iraq prisons, like going into, like that was the original attack on Iraq. They had issues with other human rights violations. France seems to be like leading among the countries on, you know, being anti-US policy. France had a lot of issues with the Trump administration when it came to the pulling out of the Iran deal. And in general, treating like the Trump administration, like the whole, we know like relationships between the United States and many European countries went, you know, wasn't as good as before during the Trump administration, right? So that was also a thing. But all of these examples, like not over the Iraq war, not over the, I don't know, the human rights violations in Iraq, not over Trump's pulling out of the Iran deal or Trump's other fiascos, did they ever even come close to reclaiming an ambassador? It was even, it was unimaginable for France, like for situations to get, for the relationships to get so bad for, like, okay, so we see France like, oh, France thinking like, okay, United States shouldn't have attacked Iraq, right? But they didn't see that as something worth pulling ambassadors from. But this deal, them not buying $50 billion worth of submarine was such a punch in the gut that they're reclaiming, that they're calling back their ambassadors. They're calling them back, right? What does that tell you, Ali? Doesn't that tell you that weapon deals seem to be a much bigger red line for relationship between these countries,
it does, but,
and
but,
human rights violations and anything else?
Yeah, but this is about a little bit more than that, right? So it's the weapons deal fell through. So I think what France felt in this was more the betrayal, because France, I don't know, at least from what I know, they want a presence in that Indo-Pacific region where Australia is. That's where, you know, the US and China, you know, they're sort of, that standoff occurs. France owns a bunch of islands there. They've got a few naval bases in the region, and they basically want a presence there. And Australia was a huge part of it. So now that that's gone, the entire plan of France's presence in the Indo-Pacific has basically gone to shit, right? And the same thing, they also wanted the European Union to come up with a plan for it. Mm-hmm. And the European Union did come up with a plan for it, but it happened the same day that the AUKUS thing happened, so nobody even heard about it.
Okay, okay, here's a comeback to that argument, okay? Mm. If there's going to be any intimidation against China in that area, it's going to be through the US, right? Like, France is not going to be able to have any form of, like, relative pressure, right? So if it's about, like, creating, you know, some form of pushback against China, European countries should be happy with the United States having a higher presence over there, because they are not going to be able to do it, right? So I just think, no, this is about them losing out on a deal. I think it's more about that than anything else. It was like, oh, that's their language. Even they, I mean, it would be in their favor if what you're saying is the case, it would have been in their favor to frame it like that. But even they're not framing it like that. They were like, This was our deal. We're going to sue. See you in court.
But I think they're kind of the deal is a big part of it. But the big problem with the deal is that the deal means that Australia is not going to be a key helper for France to maintain its influence in that region, or maintain its presence in that. They have a regional strategy for the Indo-Pacific, right? And when Australia bows out of it, then that entire plan goes up in shambles. And that's another thing with the European Union now separate from the UK. that's also another issue. So the France has realized that, like, they can't, they basically don't have the pull that they did before in these sort of regional, when they want any kind of regional influence in places like this, if they don't have the European behind them, the European Union behind them. So it's a, I think there's more to it than just a weapons deal. The weapons deal is definitely a thing. It's a huge amount of money. There is a betrayal aspect of it. It was negotiated. The alternative was negotiated behind their backs. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there, but I think the loss of Australia as a partner.
Okay. Ali, the thing is that those other things, I don't think it would be a strong enough reason for France to call back its ambassador. You know, like, we have had France being angry with the United States over many other things. It has never been like this, right? It just, like, let me give you another example. United States and Turkey have had major disagreements with each other. Major, you know, fighting on, over languages, over Israel, over involvement in Syria, over involvement in Libya, right? United States is interested in its, like, influence in Libya and Turkey, like, you know, all these, like, sometimes Turkey has, like, different interests, you know, than United States in Syria. Like we saw a lot of tension between United States and Turkey over there, over what needs to be done in Syria, especially over the Kurds, right? This, you know, this major tensions between United States and Turkey over the whole Kurdish question. No, I should say it like the Kurdish thing, right? But when, what was the red line for United States? Like, we saw big words over, like, you know, so many topics, right? So many things that Turkey and United States have a conflict over, and their allies as well. But what was it that United States would, that Turkey did, that United States reacted in ways that it had never reacted to all these other things? Even when it comes to Turkey threatening United States influence in so many in the region, right? Those were not the red lines for United States. Do you know what was it that made United States go full on sanction mode on Turkey and, like, have, like, devastating impact in Turkey's economy?
Does it have something to do with weapons deals?
Yeah, it was when Turkey decided to buy weapons from Russia instead of United States.
Yeah,
that was the red line. That was when United States, like, okay, no. They went full on sanctions. None of those other things motivated.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, there might be something there. It's just interesting. I just think that it's, like, you know, France is now working with India, so they're establishing alliance with India now and trying to build their regional strategy with them, and they're backing off of Australia. It's weird.
Do you think if those factors were there, but the loss of the deal was not a factor, that France would have called its ambassador back?
No, of course, the loss of the deal.
I'm just thinking the main element of the main factor that has made the tension this high was the loss of the deal, rather than those other factors.
I think they're related, right? I think the loss of the deal from Australia, this negotiation behind their backs, that entire thing, right? And the undermining of the French strategy, the regional strategy there. And all of it goes together. I don't think you can separate them from each other. Like, if they had negotiated something else that was worth a lot less.
I'm not separating them from each other. I'm just saying, if you could come up with an alternative situation where France's presence in the region would have been lowered or, like, challenged, but it wasn't losing a deal. Like, if you could find an alternative, like,
yeah,
I don't think
the deal is a huge step
in.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But anyway,
we should respond to patron question. Yes.
Yes. So let's do it. So D has a question. So let's do D's question first, right? And D's question is, and I'll read it out. D Boudreau is asking, how do you deal with people who blame the U.S. for literally everything? Do you think, for instance, the Salvadorian government would take any blame for the death squads during their civil war or only blame the U.S. for providing arms? Likewise, people always say the U.S. created the Islamic State. I get this all the time as an American. I am a history nerd. I know the wrongs committed, but damn, do we have to take credit for all the bad in the world? When you are a superpower and it's a unipolar world in terms of, you know, until the late 80s, there were two superpowers. You had the US and the Soviet Union. Now it's basically the US, and the US obviously has every country has to deal with the US. A lot of blame is going to come towards you. A lot of it will be legitimate. Some of it will not be legitimate. So, you know, You're right about that. I think it's just inevitable when you're in a position of global leadership that people, when things are wrong, when you influence so much of the policies and everything that happens in the world, the economics in the world, and then regionally too. I mean, we talk about it here in Canada. I mean, the U.S. policies often affect Canada a lot more than Canada's own government's policies do. Same is true for Iraq. Same is true for Saudi Arabia. Same is true for so many other countries. So when things go wrong, you know, the blame will come to the U.S. And when things go well, the regional leaders take the credit. It's always been kind of the case, unfortunately.
I want to also respond to this question, Mehdi.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that a lot of people just have this black and white mentality, and they just look at everything in, well, a lot of things in binary, you know, terms. Like, they think, like, yes, is it true that United States had an influence in the creation of the Islamic State? Yes. In the Taliban? Yes. But a lot of people say that, and then their understanding is that it's all United States' fault, and they don't understand that things are a lot more complicated, and it's a whole bunch of countries' government's fault. United States was one of the reasons why these things happen, right? Like, for example, let's look at the Taliban. A lot of people look at the history of United States' involvement in Afghanistan and show how that led to the creation of the Taliban. Is that true? Yes, that is true, okay? What they fail to take account for is the fact that Pakistan's government was heavily involved. Saudi, you know, Pakistan government is the number one country you should be blaming for the existence of Taliban. Saudi, if you want to talk about funding, then Saudi, what you should also mention Saudi Arabia's influence in funding these Mujahideen groups against the Soviet Union. With worse intentions than even United States had when it comes to the funding of Mujahideen, right? You should also blame, you know, a lot of people in Afghanistan as well. Like, these, a lot of these issues are not, wouldn't have been possible if certain values were not prevalent in Afghanistan, right? You know, so you should, like, give some agency to the people in Afghanistan that are actually directly committing these crimes and hold them responsible. It's not like everything, you know, everything is because of United States. I mean, again, you shouldn't deny. I think people think that if you highlight the role of other people in all this mess and chaos, then you're making excuses for United States and saying your United States was not involved. And then a lot of people who mention United States was involved, they're saying that these other countries have no involvement. Oh, another country that you should be blaming is Egypt. Egypt was before the Mujahideen were even a great force in Afghanistan. Egypt was the source of, is where a lot of this ideology, a lot of these Islamic ideology was exported from to Afghanistan, that created the base for the Mujahideen to eventually become this influential. And I think the main country, actually, the number one country that you should blame for the situation in Afghanistan is the Soviet Union, both before and after they invaded Afghanistan. And also, I want people to understand that the Soviet Union's attack on Afghanistan was a lot more deadly, a lot more violent than the United States. Like, the Soviet Union in 1 year managed to be responsible for around a million Afghans, okay? Like, in the 20 years United States has been in Afghanistan, the death toll has been how much, Ellie? It's been 30,000? 30,000, I think?
Yeah. Yeah.
30,000 over 20 years. And the Soviet Union was managed to kill, like, a million in 1 year. They basically... The bombing on Herat by itself was devastating. It was like it was genocidal. It was crazy. And yeah.
Another thing is a lot of the deaths.
Let me finish this. Yeah. Okay, no, you go ahead.
Go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
No, I'm just saying, like, and even before the Soviet Union takeover of Afghanistan, Afghanistan was going through a phase that everything looked fantastic. Afghanistan, like their king stepped down. No, he didn't step down, but he reduced his power because he was interested in democracy and giving more power to the people. The people were being educated. People's lives were improving. Like it seemed everything was going in the right direction. Everything in Afghanistan for a while was going in the right direction until communism showed up, right? Before, even before the Islamic ideology, the thing that broke Afghanistan was not at first, was not Islamism. The thing that broke Afghanistan at first was communism, right? And that was exported directly, intentionally from the Soviet Union through the military to Afghanistan, right? So Afghanistan was, before it broke apart, was a competition between three different ideologies. Islamism from Egypt, Enlightenment values from United States, and communism from the Soviet Union. The Islamism was coming through the from Egypt, was being promoted through the mosques. The Enlightenment values from United States was being promoted through the school system, and communism from the Soviet Union was being promoted through the military, like because the soldiers were being trained in the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union decided to train them not just how to fight, but also ideologically sell the communism to them. And what these soldiers brought to Afghanistan, that ideology destroyed Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say that what was working in Afghanistan, like if you want to talk about the bad influence of the United States, also let's talk about the good influence of the United States. The Enlightenment values that was coming from the United States through the school system in Afghanistan, that was having a major positive effect on Afghanistan. That was a good form of intervention in Afghanistan. So again, nothing is this black and white as people make it seem to be. I'm going to defend United States on one thing, but after you speak, but go ahead.
No, one. I just wanted to add, like when you talked about the casualty figure in Afghanistan with the US invasion, a lot of that, according to the Human Rights Watch, I think up to 70, a little around 70 something percent of the deaths of Afghan civilians were due to sectarian violence, right? In Afghanistan and Iraq, both due to sectarian violence between different rival religious groups among the locals. So, you know, like the Shia Sunni sectarian violence in Iraq actually claimed a large percentage of the civilians. During the intervention. Mm-hmm. So the Soviet Union was definitely not as discriminating when it came to civilian casualties. They didn't care at that time, like nobody cared. At this point, when the US goes in, obviously they do care. They have their own organizations. There's US watchdog organizations making sure that the US doesn't do a lot of these things. So that's actually another big difference that kind of goes in favor of the US. Not really, but it does. So
right. So one last thing I want to point to, again, this is referred to Dee's question. The United States is the world superpower, and by a huge margin to all the other countries combined. Okay. And given the nature of how powerful the United States is as a country, it is, again, I'm trying to frame this in a way to not make it seem like I'm excusing it. It's not justifiable, but it is predictable. Oh, here, I was going to say understandable, but people might think understandable means justifiable. So I'm not going to say understandable. I'm going to say predictable. It's predictable for the world if such a superpower is a source of harm. When it is a source of harm, it's going to be a source of harm to a bigger scale than other countries, right? What I'm arguing is that if other countries were the superpower right now with other values, they would have been a bigger source of harm. Like if China was the world superpower or if Iran was the world superpower, the harm that you would see from the United States would be dramatically higher. But just for the same reason why United States, when it does cause harm, it's going to be on a bigger scale compared to other countries because it's the world superpower, But it works also when it comes to benefit as well. On the other side, like whenever there is a natural disaster, the country that is there first is the United States when it comes to helping. And the country that leaves last is also the United States. And the country that has the most amount of aid, the most amount of, when it comes to fighting disease, when it comes to fighting, you know, people being devastated by natural disasters, when it comes to fighting fire, when it comes to technology, okay? The entire world is now benefiting from technology that was that came out of the United States, and it's helping so much. Like, I don't know if people understand just having access to computers, how much countries have benefited, how much the economy of the whole globe, of the most poorest countries, have benefited because of the computer, because of the internet, because of social media. Where did these come from? These all came from the United States. Fighting the diseases that have been eradicated, a lot of this comes from medicine that has been made in the United States, okay? So I'm not saying any of this excuses the war crimes by the United States, okay? I'm not saying you should be like, oh, well, okay, they're causing, the United States is responsible for aiding Saudi Arabia for the world's greatest human rights violation of our time in Yemen. That is true, okay? Is it also true that this pandemic that we're all dealing with is being saved because of the medicine the United States also came up with? Yeah, that's also true. We would have probably have to deal with this pandemic 5 extra years. I don't know if it wasn't because of the United States. I don't know. I don't know how many more years.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that you could, United States is not one entity. You don't have to say like, is it good or bad? There are different institutions, different organizations, different people involved. You don't even have to make a judgment call on one person, okay? You could make different judgments on different positions on one individual. And if you could do that with one individual, do you really think that you have to have the entire judgment on an entire country? No. You could be like, this policy is bad. I hate this policy. Oh, this policy is good. I like this policy. So don't look at one country and just judge it as good or bad. It's much more complicated.
I actually have a really good, quick example of that just to illustrate the people who don't get it. And this is actually an argument in favor of, you know, free market capitalism. You have the US, at least when I was growing up, before the internet, before social media, we only saw the Israeli side of things. Like in the Israel-Palestine conflict, we only saw the images and the news, everything that came out of Israel. You know, all the reporters used to report out of it. Now with social media, with Twitter and YouTube and all these things, when they started coming up, we started seeing images from Gaza as well. We start seeing images from the West Bank and all of these other things. And that obviously that helped change the opinion of the world on the conflict, but the US was still supporting Israel, and they found it frustrating, even though it was US private, like some of the biggest companies in the US that were facilitating this other side of the story that was coming out. So that's a kind of interesting way to look at how it happens. Another example is like when, you know, the San Bernardino shooting that happened, the Islamic State shooting. And that guy's phone, they needed it to get it unlocked, and Apple said, no, we're not going to do it. You know, the FBI and Apple were at loggerheads with each other. So some of those things, I mean, they do come up against each other. And there are these sort of internal conflicts in the US that happen precisely because you have these different institutions. You have the US foreign policy machine, and then you have the US corporations that are really trying to empower the voices of the common person that protect their privacy, often in places that the US doesn't really want to have that influence come up. So it's good. I find that a really, really interesting point you brought up. That might be actually a topic for a whole separate episode. But I'm going to go to the next question. Dee Boudreau is saying, you know, at 11:39 p.m., is it a sign of the world drawing new alliances? So interestingly, I want to read like something from the New York Times, and this is an article by, I'll tell you who it's by later, but it's called No Wonder the French Are Angry, right? So here they talk about, you know, what I was kind of saying, Australia was key to the French strategy. Beyond the sale of submarines, France foresaw a partnership with Australia that would add an important pillar to the presence in the region, and then now the plan is in shambles. And then they're saying later, to rebuild its regional strategy, France is now turning to India, with which it already cooperates closely. At work here is a realignment of alliances in the region, rammed through by the United States with as much consideration for its allies as it showed in the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. The world order is mutating, alliances multiplying. The Anglosphere tightened around the Five Eyes intelligence sharing network comprising America, Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand is regrouping in the South Pacific. That leaves no space for continental Europeans, even though they have common interests. And France is, you know, continental European country. So your question is actually quite on the point. Is it the sign of the world drawing new alliances? And that is actually happening. Especially in that region. So I find that, I think that that's really interesting too. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's, you know, the French foreign minister, I think it's a foreign minister who's basically doing the talking, right? Like, I mean, Macron's been.
And Macron quiet. Too. No, Macron has. Both of them have gone like, no, Macron has not been quiet.
but the foreign minister, like one thing he said that was interesting when they asked him, they're like, has President Biden, has what he's done, is it similar now to what the previous, you know, what Trump did? And he's like, yes, without the tweets. He's like, yes, but without the tweets.
No, this is what I'm saying, because people were saying Trump as alienating United States from EU, but all the things Trump did, the EU is not saying this as not as bad when it comes to alienating EU from this one thing that Biden did. They think this was this deal by itself, they're seeing as a bigger backstab than the entire Trump presidency. Like, it's not even comparable to them. They're seeing this as worse. But again, I don't know if because we criticize Trump from alienating United States, but I don't know if we could say like, oh, now Biden is alienating United States. Well, he's not alienating United States because he's making deals with the UK and Australia.
He sided with Brexit, didn't he? I mean, the whole thing was the UK. What Biden did was he secretly worked with the post-Brexit United Kingdom and abandoned the European Union, which is what the Democrats kind of wanted to do. They were on the side of non-Brexit. So that's also another sort of the European Union and France and continental Europe is generally.
But they've got kind of makes off of that. They're pissed off, but to be fair to Biden, it makes sense, okay? The only reason why UK is in this deal is because the UK already had, United States had already gave the submarines to the UK, I think. Yeah. And maybe there's other reasons. And the reason why Australia is in the deal is because what we touched upon earlier, proximity to China. The main ally that you need over there is one of these Commonwealth countries that is also in China's backyard. That's why it needed to be with Australia. I mean, come on, France. Your submarines, I mean, I'm sure your submarines are good and all, France, but they're nothing compared to United States submarines. And when it comes to having a united front against China, you need United States nuclear submarines somewhere close to China, okay? And honestly, so here's the thing. EU might be like really angry right now, especially because they think like you know what they're saying, Ali? Like, why do we even need NATO? You guys are like making other NATO parallel stuff without the EU in there, right? Without the rest of Europe. Like, so before this new AUKUS deal, all right, you just referred to the Five Eyes, right? The Five Eyes countries involve, as you mentioned, Australia. So for people who don't know, Five Eyes is like another alliance. It's between five countries, and this is mostly intelligence, right? It's intelligence sharing, right? Yeah. So this was another alliance that existed before this, was Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States. None of the EU countries, right? And now with this AUKUS, we also have that. By the way, Canadians are angry with Trudeau for not being part of this AUKUS deal. They're like, why are we not in this deal? Which is funny, interesting.
Sorry, go ahead.
But people are like saying like, okay, given that United States is making all these alliances that is not because it's like parallel to NATO, like you're making NATO obsolete by making all these other arrangements with countries that don't involve the European countries, EU is saying like, we need to stop depending on United States when it comes to defense and military. We need to make our own NATO parallel military stuff that is just the EU. Like, we need to make an EU army without the US, so that we're less dependent, and without the US and the UK, so we're less dependent on those. The problem is that their military relative to US is like so, it's like nothing. I mean, it's huge. I mean, come on, German military is big compared to a lot of countries like in the Middle East and stuff, but compared to the US, when it comes to actually being a major, like, I mean, the EU is a great force, maybe against Russia's army, but to be able to go all the way to China and have a presence there and become like be a big deal, like EU is not going to be able to do it without the US, right?
Yeah,
but they still need to start working on an EU army, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're going to. So that's, I think this is why I love this question so much, D, is that, you know, is this a sign of the world drawing new alliances? What you're going to see right now is France has sort of seen that, okay, now that continental Europe as a continental European country, it is out of the picture. Right, all of these other people are going to work behind their back, and their former allies are not really someone they could trust. Pulled back their ambassadors, working with India. So now you're going to see more of an independent, the European Union becoming more independent, more economically independent, more militarily, starting building up their defense. And France is going to be kind of leading this. So they will be. I think that's going to be.
I mean, they're still going to be tied to the U.S. I mean, they can't, right? Like these countries,
of course, yeah.
The EU and the U.S. just have too much mutual interest and too tied to each other for them not to be working with each other. It's not about like a lot of people like. It's not about like not working with the U.S. or cutting ties with the U.S. It's about like having alternatives so that they're not so much dependent on the U.S. when it comes. I mean, and the U.S. might. I mean, the Americans might also. American taxpayer might be like, "Well, it's about time because a lot of your defense has been dependent on our tax money, anyways, right? Like a lot of the security EU enjoys is because of the money that the American taxpayer give for their military, and Canada and Western Europe, like all of Europe, is like." Well, if anybody attacks us, America is going to come help us anyway. Like the American taxpayer should be like, yeah, you guys should spend on your own army. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but that's still probably going to happen. I mean, it's kind of, there is a little bit of a realignment and a shift. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see. But either way, like we're well over time now, but this is really fascinating stuff. I think it's going to be interesting. It's going to change a lot.
And Susanna is reminding us how to properly YouTube. Thank you very much, Susanna.
That's exactly what we're going to do. Right now,
Susanna saying, boys, don't forget to tell people to like and share. Well, guys, if you're watching this live, you're a patron, so you don't share this one if you're watching the video live. But if you're listening to the audio version of this, then please do like and share so that you can help us grow the channel. That would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
So for non-patrons who are listening to this, if you're listening to this on YouTube, please like. Please hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you're notified every time there's a new video. And we have lots of short video clips and a lot of really, really interesting topical stuff that we put out on a daily basis. So you'll definitely get a chance. You'll get notified of all of those. If you are listening to this on your podcast app, like on iTunes or on, you know, any of the other podcast apps, please give us a rating, and that'll help feature us and it'll help bring us up and make us more prominent. If you like what you hear today, then please do consider going to patreon.com/sjme and signing up as a patron for as little as $1 a month. For that, you get 5 to 6 episodes every month. You get to watch them. You get to participate. And if you cannot participate live, you can submit your questions. You can put your questions on the Patreon page under the live stream announcement. And those questions will be given priority and will be read first, like Dee Boudreau's question was today. And it was addressed and answered first.
Link to Patreon is in the description if you don't want to type it up.
Yeah, it's in the description. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. I think this is great. We're probably going to have more topics on this.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be talking about this a little bit later.
We covered these topics very well, Ellie. I must say, I know it sounds self-congratulatory, but I think we cover it better than any other source that I know.
I also come here to learn. I actually learn a lot from, sort of talking to you and hearing the stuff that you've done. So, you know, Armin's pretty good at this stuff. We do have an upcoming, I think we can announce in early, well, we have our monthly Q&A, which is public. It's for everybody, happening on the 29th. That's next week on Wednesday. So that's not just going to be a Patreon thing. That everybody can join in. You can bring your friends. You can ask them to check it out. And ask us about anything you want, except for the stuff that YouTube won't let us talk about. But aside from that, yes, pretty much anything. So please do join us September 29th, same time, 11 p.m. EST. And then after that, we do have Infidel Noodle, Armin. We have booked her. So Susanna and I will be talking to Infidel Noodle on, I think it's Monday, October 4th right now, but we'll finalize it later on. So
yes, that's great. I'm going to always refer to her as Noodly Noodles, because I forgot her name and I said Noodly Noodles and I thought like it was a better name, so I will refuse to call her Infidel Noodles. Anyways, okay. Yeah, guys, check that out. That's going to be a great show.
All right.
Okay, guys, thank you, everyone, and talk to you soon. Bye. Right.
Bye. Be best.
Be best. Oh,
yeah. The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.